morning to all of you. I do have a question. Did you speak in your hour?
Yes, ma'am.
And did you find out about the new addition to the family?
Yes.
Okay, we couldn't talk about that in the first hour because some of the folks in that hour hadn't been to church yet. I thought that was cute. I was coming down the stairs this morning, and a member of the first hour said, I haven't been here in a few weeks. How far have we gotten? And my answer was 1 Corinthians. And he didn't believe me. But we did. Let me explain for those of you who maybe are new or maybe missed the last couple of weeks. We are in Judges. If you look at Judges, the word judge is a word that is synonymous in usage anyway with leader or I think maybe leader is the best word. The pattern in the book of Judges is an awful and terrible pattern. People would forget God, would rebel against what he had asked them to do and told them to do. They would go and worship other gods. Consequences would fall. The consequences were so awful that finally a few people will remember, wait a minute, God said we didn't have to live this way. And so they would appeal to God. God would raise up a leader. And that leader would bring them back, and as long as that leader lived, and maybe a generation or two afterwards, they would be close to the Lord, and then they'd fall away again, the whole thing would start again. If you walk through the book of Judges, there was a list that used to be on the right-hand board. You find 12 names, people identified as judges. There's many other names, but 12 names of people identified as judges. And to put this in context, when Judges is over, pretty soon you come to the book of 1 Samuel, and Samuel becomes the last of the judges and the first of a line of prophets that stretches across the rest of the Old Testament. So Samuel provides a bridge from one kind of leadership to a different kind of leadership. Out of those 12, 4 are mentioned in a verse in Hebrews. There's a verse in Hebrews in the chapter on the roll call of faith that talks about faithful people and all things that happen. As the writer of Hebrews finishes the detailed discussion of different ones, he says, and there's really not enough time to talk about, and in that verse he names 6 people. I've said for a couple of weeks it was 5, but I went back and looked at 6. The first 4 are 4 of the 12 people in Judges. And then it names David and one other. I forget who the other one was, maybe Samuel. But it names 2 others that were leaders of this sort. So what we're doing is looking through the book of Judges and looking in particular at those 4 people to whom Judges gives a lot more space than some of the other leaders that are there. Now, we're looking at the third of those 4 a couple of weeks ago. This was a fellow by the name of Jephthah. And toward the end of the discussion of Jephthah in the book of Judges, something very strange is mentioned. It mentions that they're in a series of battles and they were able to tell the difference between friend and foe by whether the person could or could not pronounce a certain word. The word, as best I know to pronounce it, is shibboleth. And one translation I saw said that people could say shibboleth, or if they were foe, they would say sibboleth. They couldn't make the SH come out right. In any event, around 2000 in the television series West Wing, there was a moment in that particular episode, where a container ship had been investigated by the Coast Guard off the coast of California. In one cargo container on that ship, they found a bunch of Chinese refugees. They claimed to be evangelical Christians. They claimed to ask for refuge. But because they were still at sea, U.S. law said they were supposed to be sent back. If they made it to land, then they could make such a request. And the president was quietly trying to decide, do I allow this cargo container to get to land? So he had one of the leaders of the Chinese group come to the White House and begins to ask him all kinds of questions about the Bible. The one that I remember most clearly is, can you name the 12 disciples? And the guy couldn't, but he named about 11 of them, maybe 10 of them. Anyway, several questions of that sort go by, all of which are just fine points. Do you know the Bible? And the fellow playing the Chinese leader looks and says, Mr. President, I think you're trying to figure out if I know how to say the shibboleth. And I thought, I've never seen Hollywood get that kind of a reference in context. It was right for that particular context. Now, about that same time, Jim Pardew, who was pastor of our church at the time, had given a series of sermons, and in those sermons he had talked about the marks of authentic Christian leaders. And I realized, sort of putting these two together, the question could be asked, how do you tell whether somebody knows how to say shibboleth? How do you know, let me write it this way, what does someone say, or what can or what does someone do to show that he or she is Christian, to show that he or she is worth listening to? To say it another way, how do you recognize authentic leaders for and in the church? And so what we're doing now is coming to 1 and 2 Corinthians to look through to see if we can find some of these marks. Now, in the first hour, I've got about a dozen people who are taking notes. Were any of you here last week and did you take notes? I want to honor you if you did. Okay. Did you take notes last week? You weren't here last week. Okay. Judy's, but she's gone. Did you take notes? You weren't here last week. Okay, so what I want to do, if I can, we went through six of these last week. I need to give you a little preview right now. In the first hour, we went through six last week. How many do you think we got through this week?
Two.
Exactly. We got through two. So this could be a short lesson. What happened was that I was able to draw a little bit of extra commentary about, but let me just walk through the first six. The references are on the board if you want to look at these later. What I promised the first hour I would do, which by doing it I'll also fulfill a promise to you, I'm going to go into the notes I have, strip away the comments for the moment, but put the references, and I'll post that online so that if you have the access, the website is up on the far right, www.discoveryclass.net. If you go there, you will see the references, so whether you write them down or don't write them down. I'll either get those done within the next 4 hours, or I'll get them done sometime Wednesday night. It won't happen on Monday or Tuesday. But that will be the plan. So we've done the first six, and what I want to do is go back through and review those. If you weren't here, I want to give you a chance to catch up. If you were here, I want to give you a chance to think through some of this one more time. And the key here is not what does somebody believe, but how do they act. Okay? Now, we're still in building context, and I want to take a second or two and give you one more thing to put up against this. A very long time ago, when our children were little, we were in a different church. We'd come to Richmond, we weren't in this church yet. That church did what this church does sometimes. It had a workshop on things that might be helpful to the development of the people in the church. This particular one was called Effective Parenting. There was a friend of ours, it was a person we knew very, very well, who was a child psychology professor at VCU. And he taught a workshop, 5-6 weeks, I think, of an hour or so a week, that we went through this workshop. I remember we had a book. The title of the book was Parent Effectiveness Training, which is an acronym of PET. I remember that the book itself was yellow and that the slip cover was blue. And I can even remember some of the pages on it. When I walked away from this workshop, I walked away with two central ideas that I realized did not only apply to parents and children and the interaction between them, but it also applied to the interaction of people in general. And one of the things that I remember learning or hearing in this was that if you talk to your child, or more broadly, if you talk to anybody else about a problem of some kind, that if you do so with you statements, you're liable not to get very far, and if you do so with I statements, you've got at least a chance of getting somewhere. And the definition, as I recall it, was you statements means you use the word you a lot. You've got this problem, you need to do this, you need to do this. What do those kinds of words engender? Many of you are parents, most of you are parents, you know something about this. What does this generate in the child? Defensiveness. And you quit listening to whatever the problem is that's concerned you. You're simply trying to get your defense ready. You're getting your rebuttal ready. On the other hand, if you use I statements, the word I is used liberally and the word you is used hardly at all, then somehow the defensiveness doesn't jump up nearly so early, and there's a good chance of communicating. The problem was, though, there was a codicil to this. That's one of my words for the new year. I'm going to try to use that word three times during 2013. A codicil to this said you can't use an I statement to talk about a problem unless the I statement expresses a tangible and concrete effect that that problem is having on you. And that's interesting. If you're talking about parents with teenagers and you don't like the way that teenager's wearing their hair, you have to find some tangible and concrete effect it's having on you. I remember that's one of the examples because my friend Andy said, I don't think you're going to find a tangible and concrete effect for that one. Now, you may find one for lots of other things, but because that says whoever's speaking has to work on it. So the spirit here is, it's not beliefs, but actions we're looking at. It's not things that people hold dearly, but things that they do out of the values that they hold. So we're going to be talking about things that people say or do, but those are things that emerge from attitudes and so forth in the heart. So here we go. The very first one, the church in Corinth, this is maybe the last piece of reintroduction that I need to do. The church in Corinth had its problems were divisions. People were, I'm proud of what I'm doing and I'm putting down everything you're doing because that's a way that I can have dominance over you. And so Paul is talking about where do those divisions come from and what can he do to limit those. And you realize this is mark number one. If you read those verses, you'll see things that support this. You realize an authentic Christian leader is someone who looks for ways to encourage and build unity and not to encourage factions and fighting. And it is interesting. There are some people who claim to be leaders. I suspect this doesn't limit itself to Christian settings. I suspect it applies to lots of other settings as well, but that's where we're applying it. Who encourage the factions and the fighting, as opposed to looking for unity. Unity is not uniformity. Unity is not unanimity. It's not everybody agrees on every single thing, but that people find ways of working together and recognize the things that bind them together much more strongly than the things that might separate or divide them. That's number one. Number two, if you go and read the verses, what you find is Paul is probably echoing some of what had happened in Athens. I think the timetable in Acts, I may have this wrong, I think the timetable in Acts was that he had been to Athens and then a little bit later came to Corinth. I think that's the timetable. If so, then this really does work. In Athens, he had tried to use oratory and brilliance, and he was a brilliant guy, to convince the philosophers of Athens of the truth of the Christian message, and had failed miserably. And so he says to the people of Corinth, when I came to you, I didn't come with oratorial brilliance. I didn't come to dazzle you with human knowledge. I didn't come to convince you with human power. I came instead in humility to try to let God's power go to work in you and let that be what convinces you of the truth of things. So that's where the second one comes out. Does the person claim special knowledge? Do they seek to impress other people with their credentials or with their brilliance? Or does the person offer what he or she knows about Jesus with humility? Now, somewhere about here, I need to get a sign and put it on the ground. The sign looks like this. We're getting into places where I am being critical, or at least potentially critical, of some folks in some places at some times, and I am expressing opinions, and I invite you to see them as such, and let's not us fight, but rather consider the ideas that are here. Okay? Any comments so far on the first two that we've just reviewed? Some of you who were here last week might have something. There's a lot of turnover. A lot of people who weren't here last week. Okay. All right, number three. Does the person encourage other people under their leadership to grow and develop and mature spiritually? Or do they encourage dependence? Here's the problem. If you encourage the development of independence and maturity, then what you have is an independent, mature voice that could conceivably stand against yours. And sometimes it's simpler, if you want people to listen to you and do what you want, it's simpler not to let them develop an independent voice. So once again, does the person encourage people to grow and develop and mature spiritually, or does that person encourage dependence? Number four, a really big one. Who gets the credit for the things that happen? Does the leader claim the credit? Or does the leader point back to God? I said last week, I'm quoting Jim Pardue when I say it, when you walk out of a place where you've been with this person, do you say to yourself, wow, that guy's the best preacher or that woman is the best speaker I've ever heard? Or do you say, my goodness, do I see God more clearly now? That's a tough line to walk because there's some pretty bright people out there. Does the person take credit for the things that happen? Can you feel some of these interlocking and connecting with others? One's sort of one facet, one's another facet.
Bill, is it a slight chance that somebody who makes those comments not have a relationship with the Lord so much that when they hear that person speak, that they may conceivably understand that they are connecting with God and speaking at a point that does bring out points that that person's never really realized? I'm being a little bit of a devil's advocate from a person who's not church regular, who does not have a relationship, but they are astounded at that person's speaking ability and expressing views.
And that's why I want to be careful, because I'm talking about, does somebody sort of look for that,
right,
encourage that? Or if it comes that way, do they find a way of celebrating the fact that the person is seeing that better?
And I think your point is well taken, that somebody who's churched every week, they should feel like they've been, you know, felt God's presence more from that sermon as opposed to the glory of the speakers.
As long as you've said it and you've said it well, let me take it one step further. I think it's rare for anybody to come to the Lord who has not had some influence from some other human being.
Sure.
And I think it is natural, right, appropriate for them to have gratitude for that person and for the role they played in bringing them in. I don't think I'm talking about that.
Right.
But I am talking about, when you finish, do you have a sense of being closer to the Lord? You may express it in the other way, but is that what's really happening? A really authentic Christian leader, spending time in their presence, you begin to see God better. That doesn't mean you don't have appreciation for the person who's helped you and that you don't express that appreciation. But essentially, do you appreciate, or do you end up praising and almost worshiping the person? And I think the analogy that I'll offer for you, Jesus said at one point early in his ministry, I think to Nicodemus, just as the serpent was lifted on the stick in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up and all who look to him will be saved. Words to that effect. Remember that? Okay, what's that snake in the wilderness he was talking about? You remember? Children of Israel were wandering. It hadn't been too long for us. Plague came out, they made a bronze serpent, put it up on a stick, and those who looked at it were healed, right? Okay, you come over to 2 Kings, I think it is, that old bronze serpent is still there and people are worshiping it. Do you worship what brings you to a right relationship with God? Or do you worship God himself? And some leaders like that and don't sort of deflect. Other leaders do say, wait a minute, don't worship me. If I'm helping you see some things, let's celebrate that you're seeing things more clearly. And that's the piece I think many of these are a tightrope. There's another tightrope that I think we hit in the first hour, and I'll try to bring that back up if one of you doesn't. That was a good addition. Others?
Yeah. Years ago, there was a some old preacher on the radio. He's dead now, but he was a great preacher, and I remember something, he got an award at some point, or someone acknowledged him for how great of a biblical expositor he was. And I remember he said he would take the award and, you know, in all humility, but he said, really, he was nothing more than just a newspaper boy on the street corner that was just sitting there saying, this is what you ought to check out, you ought to read this. It's extra special. And he said that's how he considered himself, just a, you know, that the stereotype in the movie of a dirty newspaper boy trying to tell you this is something you need to read. That was his take on it.
And I'm not saying we shouldn't honor people who are effective at these kinds of things. We shouldn't. I'm not saying we shouldn't appreciate them. We should.
Well, I was speaking also to a person who may be naive in knowing what to say correctly to the pastor.
Right.
You know, if he...
Yeah, because you don't want to chide someone.
Right. I mean, that's all they know to say. And it is taken, and they do appreciate it. They do understand it. They did have a moving experience. Mm-hmm. That's sometimes all they know to say.
And they shouldn't be squelched for doing
so. Somebody behind you, you know, you hear or whatever, I mean, that may be all they know to say.
Okay. Number four. That was number four. Number five. The verses are up there if you want to look at those later. We're still reviewing. The summary of this was, does the leader respect the value of every believer? Or does the leader value only a certain group? Pause. Feet carefully on the full sign. Such as those who agree with him or her. And I said last week it bears repeating. I noticed last night during the football game there was an announcement of an upcoming interview with General McChrystal that's going to be the first time he's spoken publicly since 3 years ago when he was fired. At the time McChrystal was fired, I'm hoping that you remember enough about him that I don't need to lay too much of a groundwork. Wouldn't it have been interesting if President Obama, in the process of firing him as an active general in Afghanistan or wherever he was, had said to him, look, you can't serve in that role anymore, but you're really critical of the White House and some of the decisions we're making. I'm going to give you a seat at the table. You voice your criticisms here in front of me. Let me listen to them. Let me take them into account as we make decisions. Wouldn't that have been an interesting thing to do? If a leader surrounds themselves with people who just say, whoa, that was a great idea whenever the leader speaks, you probably got some serious issues. If you have leaders who not only tolerate but encourage the independent voices, remember three or four ago, you encourage maturity, then what that says is people are beginning to give a voice to what God's insight has given to them, and maybe it doesn't always line up with yours. So that was the fifth one. The sixth one, and we're almost ready to begin when we finish this, this is in 1 Corinthians 4. Does the person have a spirit of servanthood and stewardship, or does the person seem filled with his or her own importance? You can't be a leader without a reasonably healthy ego. And I'm, again, not saying you want people who don't have an ego. You got to have that if you're going to be a leader. But if it comes to the point where the leader is forgetting his or her role as a servant, and especially their role as a steward of responsibility, then you may have some problems. Okay? Again, I had a fellow in the first hour who's retired from fairly significant industrial responsibilities. He's been in charge of production plants and all this kind of stuff. And his comment was, I've been to dozens of leadership training sessions that cost my company hundreds of thousands of dollars to send us to those things. And he says, I realize what you're bringing out of what Paul has said line up with a lot of the things I heard. At its best, this is leadership. And I remember one time we were about to hire somebody into a position that required that they provide support for other people. And I made the statement, I'd like to have a person come in with a servant, a heart of a servant. And I got such feedback, such pushback from one of my colleagues. How dare you talk about this person as a servant. That's ridiculous. It was very interesting that 3 years later, when it was clear the person we had hired hadn't quite worked out the way we thought, the person came into my office and said, "You know, I've been thinking about what you said 3 years ago. You were right and I was wrong." That is an important thing to see, because when you don't have it, things don't work very well. The idea of having servant leaders is one that slowly is beginning, it looks like to me, to take foot in some organizations across the country. I'm reading that books are being written about this, and that people who have had these kinds of experiences speak of it. And I think that's a piece of what we're talking about here. Is what drives them their own sense of self-importance, or is what drives them the role that they have as servants and stewards of the group that they're trying to lead. Okay, so that's the review. Comments or questions at any point so far? Yes? No?
First thing I thought of when you said that was just how entitled a lot of, especially like college age, coming out of college, feel like they're going to come out and get this great job, they deserve it, and I think the younger generation, you'd have a harder time finding someone who serves hard. It's almost, I guess it's how you're raised. I don't know. But these are just thoughts that were popping in my head when you were talking about that.
For 20 years, I was in charge of a scholarship program at the University of Richmond. We were giving away what are called full ride scholarships. You know what a full ride scholarship takes care of? All the tuition, all the fees, all the room, all the board. Only thing you have to pay for is travel to get back and forth and books. Maybe some supplies, deodorant, pizza. You end up having zero financial worries, or almost zero financial worries. Okay? And I watched typically 4 or 5 students a year enter this program. So we had a group that was between 16 and 20 kids at a time, freshmen through seniors, going through this program. Okay? It was amazing to me to watch and see. I don't know that I can tell you a percentage of how it broke. I think it broke maybe 70-30, but it wasn't 95-5. 70-30, the 70% seemed to show somebody is investing in me, and they're giving me all kinds of opportunities and possibilities that I otherwise wouldn't have, and boy, am I going to take advantage of those. And they were a delight to work with. And I had, and it was at least 25%, average of at least one a year, whose attitude was, "I'm great. I deserve everything I'm getting. I need more. Why am I not getting more?" And it was amazing to see the difference between those two. The kids that realized somebody, this is the language I used. There are people who have made this money available, and I'm and my committee, we are the ones who have been deputized to actually make it work. But there are people investing in you. This is a long-term investment, and they're investing hundreds of thousands of dollars in you. You owe it to them to do your best. And some of them, I'd rather play. I'd rather do this. It was amazing to me. It was amazing to me. So that the sense of entitlement, I think that's the word we would use these days, is I think it's different from what we're talking about here, the sense of self-importance versus someone who's in a servant role. But let me see. Maybe this will be worth listening to one day. Years ago, I took a year away from the University of Richmond. I took what's called a sabbatical, and I spent that sabbatical in Louisiana. My wife jokes that it's the single year in my whole life that I actually worked. I had to start work at 7:30, not 7:29, and not 7:31. I had to quit at 4:30. I could not work late. I could not come in early. I could not, no flex time. It was awful. But in the middle of that year, I was doing some things in the lab, and I called on this guy, and I said, you know, listen, I've had some things go wrong here. I wasn't able to fix it. Can you come down and give me some help? And the guy looked at me, and he said, you tried to fix it? And I said, yeah. Why'd you do that? I said, because it needed fixing. I didn't want to bother you. He says, listen, unless you bother me, unless it's clear that you need me, I don't have a job and I don't get to feed my kids. I want to do the best job for you. If you have something you need, you call me. Don't you wait and try to do it yourself. Let's work together on this. And I thought to myself, this guy's serving me, and as well as I've ever been served by anybody in my life, I think. But he's doing it because that lines up with all the other values. His value for his kids line up with that. His values for the life he's living line up with that. He's trying to do the best he can in that kind of job. Now, wherever that comes from, I think there's better places to come from than maybe that. But I thought that was pretty impressive, and I suddenly realized calling on somebody to help is not necessarily a bad thing. It's doing good things for them as well. There's almost a partnership between those who are served and those who are serving that I hadn't really thought about and hadn't really seen. I don't know how well that fits in here, but I think it does fit a little bit with what we were just talking about. Okay? All right. Now, what you get to do, only two times, and whenever we quit, we quit. But it looks like we've taken up a lot of time already. You've got to figure out what attribute is this next one going to talk about. So it's on the board there, 1 Corinthians chapter 4. So if you can find 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and sort of mark that. And then 2 Corinthians chapter 13. 2 Corinthians chapter 13. This is not the love chapter. This is a different thing. That's 1 Corinthians 13. This 1 Corinthians 4 and the verses there, verse 18 to 21, and then 2 Corinthians 13, the first three verses. Now, I want to start in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, and I want to start with verse 1. People should think of us. Sorry, verse 18 is where I wanted to start. On the assumption that I was not coming to you, some of you have become filled with your own self-importance. But I will be coming to you soon, the Lord willing. And then I'll find out not what these self-important people say, but what power they have. For the kingdom of God consists not in spoken words, but in power. What do you want then? Am I to come to you with a stick in my hand, or am I to come to you in love with a spirit of gentleness? I will tell you, there's going to be a challenge for you to pull this out. So let's go now to 2 Corinthians 13. Maybe this can help a little bit. I want you to listen to the most important word in the first sentence that I read, because I think this will help you focus a little bit. This will be the third time I have confronted you. I'm commenting now, I'm not reading anymore. Many commentators say that there actually were probably at least four letters that Paul wrote to the people at Corinth, and that we see sections of those letters gathered into what we call 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. So when he talks about three times, one of those probably was a visit, others were other letters that he wrote. This will be the third time I've confronted you. Whatever the misdemeanor, the evidence of two or three witnesses is required to sustain a charge. I gave you notice once, and now, though I'm not with you, I give you notice again, just as when I was with you for a second time, to those who sinned before and to all the others, and it is to this effect, when I come next time, I'll have no mercy. Now, what was that word I tried to get you to point to at the first of this section? Did you pick it up? Confront. That's the key. Now, can you see the heart of this particular piece? Can you express it?
The authentic leader confronts behavior that's not in keeping with the teachings of Christ.
That's part A. Can you go to part B? Look at the last little bit of the section in 1 Corinthians 4. Yeah. Which way, what do you want then? Am I going to come to you with a stick in my hand, or am I going to come to you in love with the spirit of gentleness? Which way would Paul want to do it? Okay. So the first question is, does the leader do any confronting at all when confronting needs to be done? And the second is, what spirit does the leader use? What are the spirits they can use? In what spirit could a leader confront when there's a problem that needs to be confronted? Demean, run somebody down. I put down the words condemnation, condescension, and contempt. Or they can do it in a spirit of love. Notice Paul says, listen, here's how I want to do it. Are you going to let me do it that way? I can raise my voice if I need to, but I'd rather. So the first thing is it easy to confront a problem? Is that easy? What's the typical behavior then of leaders? What's the cliche? Sweep it under the rug or kick the can down the road, right? Confronting is tough. And what happens is, the question number one is, does the leader confront when confronting is what's needed, or does the leader let the problems fester? And then the second question is, if they do confront, in what spirit do they confront? Is it demeaning, condescending, contemptuous? Is it
in public? The difference, yeah. You're taught as a parent to praise in public and reprimand in private for the best results. From your
parents. With lots of I words.
But there's a thin line between angry confrontation, public, and confronting with love and passive aggressive, right down the middle.
And I don't want to seem that I think any of these are simple. And I think it's the accumulation across the 15, not the signals that come from one, that begin to answer the question. But I think there is a fine line. Yeah. Indulgence. Do whatever you want. I'm not gonna say anything. Or every time you say something, it's hammered home.
That's what makes a good leader, is being able to discern those points.
Do you guys remember that there's a verse, I wish I could remember now, right now, what it was, where it is, and I wish I had remembered this verse in the first hour. There's this wonderful verse that says you're supposed to encourage the weak. I can't remember, it was another E word, but it came out to be scold or confront or really push on the ones that are in some other way. And when I've talked about that verse, the point that I've made is, do you notice how tough it is to know which one you need to do? You're supposed to admonish. It wasn't an E word, it was an A word. Admonish this group and encourage this group. And what I pointed out was, if you read that verse, I think Paul or whoever wrote that verse has it perfectly correct. But implied is, and you're going to have to work to know which one is which. And which one is which might actually change from time to time. You got one kid, and you need this one this day, and you need this one that day. The confrontation, does it need to be admonishing confrontation? Does it need to be encouraging confrontation? And if you're not tuned to the Spirit, you're not going to know which one is which. Yes, ma'am.
Is this 1 Thessalonians 5? And we urge you, brothers, warn those who are idle, encourage the timid, and help the weak.
That's the one. And in my translation, encourage is where it was. And one of those others, I think the word warn came out admonish. And then it says down at the end, be patient with everyone. Which sort of, it's a real powerful verse. 1 Thessalonians, where? You're good.
Well,
no, that's good. You notice how she deflected the credit? Good job. Yeah. Okay. Comments? Question?
Maybe you'll be addressing this, but you keep confronting because you said this is my third, fourth time. I keep coming to you and saying this, so you've done it. I'm sure Paul did it in the spirit of love. What's next? They're not listening.
Yeah. And I think in our day we have a phrase, tough love, which is about as tough as anything I know to apply. I can remember very clearly talking with a friend of mine whose son, this was 20 years ago, had been called up before an Henrico County judge on something he had been doing that he wasn't supposed to be doing. And my friend went to see the judge before the case was heard and said, please, please, don't be lenient. This kid needs to have consequences that come. And his comment to me was the hardest conversation I ever had. Maybe not to the judge. I think he went to the prosecutor and said, listen, this is one where I know you're going to want to give my kid a pass, and I'm not sure that's the best thing for them. Knowing how to handle that. So to me, when I look through this, here are the two keys I get. Number one is, do you confront or do you just let things slide because it's too much trouble or too much work or it has some downsides to it? And if you do confront, do you have different ways of confronting that are appropriate to the person and the circumstances? Now, the details for that and all this is really hard. But I think this is something that when you see an authentic Christian leader, you see people doing this kind of thing right and well. And the truth is, I've seen it in a few people who weren't Christian, but somehow just the instincts they have, they know the right thing to say at the right moment, and they don't let anything go that needs to be dealt with right then. And I think that goes back to what my friend said. This isn't necessarily just Christian leaders, but effective leadership in any event has some of these pieces to it. Okay? Number eight. All of these in my translation are on one two-page section, so I could just open it to one two-page section and I'm ready to go. I don't know about yours. 1 Corinthians 8, 1 Corinthians 9, there's a couple of places in 1 Corinthians 9. Let me start with 1 Corinthians 8, give you a little bit of background. Part of what was happening in this church was that they were mixing together Jewish people and Gentile people. And one of the tension lines seems to have been that there were in Corinth, this is what the commentators say, there were all kinds of false worship centers built up, many of which used animal sacrifice as part of what they did. And when the animal sacrifices were over, they would then sell the meat, and the meat was cheaper. So if you were close to the edge of poverty, you could get more food for your money if you went and bought some of this meat. But you were eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols. Some of the people in the church, I don't know that I'm clear on whether it was Jewish or Gentiles, felt that that was immoral, that that was against God's point of view to do that. Paul is saying in earlier verses, and the focus is verse 13, but in earlier verses he is saying, look, I don't care where the meat comes from. Eating food doesn't make you morally better or morally worse. Food is neutral. And he says, if food's put before me, I'm just going to eat the food. But if I find a brother saying, wait a minute, you better not eat that, that's been offered to idols, then I won't eat it because I want to keep that brother open to communication with me. So look at verse 13, 1 Corinthians 8. That is why if food can be the cause of a brother's downfall, I'll never eat meat again rather than cause my brother's downfall. Come down to 1 Corinthians 9, verse 15. However, I have never availed myself of any rites of this kind. That means from verse 1 down to verse 14, he's been talking about all kinds of things that were rites that he could claim. I have never availed myself of any rites of this kind, and I have not written what I have written in order to secure such treatment for myself. I would rather die than have that happen. Still in chapter 9, starting at verse 19. Though I was not a slave to any human being, I put myself in slavery to all people to win as many as I could. To the Jews I made myself as a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, as one under the law, even though I'm not, in order to win those under the law. To those outside the law, I acted as one outside the law. Even though I'm not outside the law, I'm under Christ's law, all in order to win those outside the law. To the weak, I made myself weak to win the weak. I accommodated myself to people in all kinds of different situations so that by all possible means I might bring some to salvation. And I do all of this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share its benefits with others. Barbara, time is short. Can you read verse 21 out of yours? I think that's, maybe it's 22.
when I am with those whose consciences bother them easily, I don't act as though I know it all and don't say they are foolish. The result is that they are willing to let me help them. Yes. Whenever a person is, whatever a person is like, I try to find common ground with him so that he will let me tell him about Christ and let Christ save him. I do this to get the gospel to them and also for the blessing I myself receive when I see them come to Christ.
Okay. Now, we're short on time, so let me take you to the heart of it. The verse that I want you to see is verse 15 in chapter 9. And the word is rights. I have never availed myself of any rights of this kind. Here's what I have written. Does the person claim rights and privileges, or does the person forego rights and privileges in order to place no barriers in the way of others coming to faith? This came home to me years ago. We made our first trip to Africa as part of a team going over to do some work. Rhonda Sadler, who many of you know, was leader of that team. And we had four or five sessions getting ready. And in those sessions, she said over and over again, one thing, I want to make lists of the things you need to make sure you bring, and I want to make a list of the things you want to leave at home. And one of the things to leave at home is your rights. And one particular example that I remember her saying was, the women on the team don't take shorts. The culture that you're going into, wear skirts. If you want to wear shorts, okay, fine, wear a skirt over the shorts. And I remember on our trip, one person violated that. It's a person that I do not want you thinking ill of. This is a wonderful person. As far as I could tell, this was a one-time thing. But I just feel like wearing shorts and nobody can tell me not to. That was what happened that afternoon. And you can almost see this coming alive. There are some leaders who demand status and privilege. There are some leaders who forego those things to have no barriers between them and people who need them. Which one are you looking at? That's what this one, I think, is talking about. Now, you may have other insights as you read this as well. Let me hasten to add, this was a place in the first hour where somebody said, you've got a problem here too, sort of like the problem we talked about a moment or two ago. You don't want to be in a position of lowering your standards to the point where you've thrown away all the Bible says about what God expects. There's a core somewhere that you don't cross. Somebody in the first hour sitting exactly where you are talked about being in a place in another country where there was a big banquet and they were toasting with alcohol. And one guy who was a partner of his on mission work raised up a glass of iced tea. A colonel sitting nearby said, get a proper drink to do that. And a general sitting a little further away said, don't you do that. Let him hold up what he wants. I've seen this man. Leave him alone. My comment was, the guy was in the hall. The guy hadn't said, they're drinking in there, so I'm going to stay someplace else. He's in the hall. He is conforming as far as he feels allowed to conform. And the witness that he gives is one that has been picked up by people pretty high up. And I think it's that same authenticity that we're talking about. I don't think Paul would have violated any of the core principles. But as he puts it, where the meat comes from doesn't matter a bit. That's not important. But there are some people who think it is important. And in honor of them, in order not to produce a barrier between us, then when I'm with them, I won't eat meat that might offend them. Do you claim the rights and privileges? Do you claim the stature and such? Or do you forego those things so as to have as few barriers as possible? One is authentic, one is less than authentic. Comments? Our pace has slowed down. We have done 2 instead of 6. Review next time may take even longer than it did this time. We will see what happens. I made a promise. I think I've said this already. I'm going to try to erase the comments on the right-hand side until we get through, but I will put the scripture lessons up, and my plan is to have that up online sometime today if I can. If not, it'll be up sometime Wednesday. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we pray today that you would teach us how to recognize when leaders are authentic. But let me also pray, because none of us is perfect, for those who aren't authentic yet, that your Spirit would work with them to let them recognize how you approach things and how you want your leaders to approach things. Help us be discerning as followers, and when we are asked to be in leadership positions, teach us to lead as your Son led. No barriers, no ego that gets in the way of the gospel reaching as many people as it can. We pray all this in your Son's name.